Welcome to today's podcast. We're going over Train the Trainer with Jim Vaughn, his section in IP Magazine. And his article this month is called What's Missing in Your Training? Jim Vaughn is with ISPC and is also a regular host on the IP Forum. Jim, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you for the opportunity. Glad to see you.
Well, you're always, thank you for the time, and you're always a wealth of information for our readers. So this article is actually, we were just talking, is a very timely topic, as short form videos and TikTok are in the news everywhere and becoming more prevalent. You're seeing a lot of stuff out in the field on social media where linemen and line workers are recording some of the unique situations they're in, but that's affecting safety. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. And I'm in sort of a unique situation in that I do third-party investigations on incidents for utilities all across the U.S. So I'm not restricted just the experience of one utility like a lot of people are. And what we consistently find is that incidents that occur in these utilities occur because somebody pretty much violated their training, which, that's kind of a hard thing to say because it sounds accusatory, and I don't want to say it that way, because a lot of times it's not that they violated their training. They simply did not know that what they were doing was wrong because of their training. And then when we're having the discussions with management over our findings and we're looking at our root cause, and we say this and this and this happened, and we find also that a lot of people in management think that that's the only crew that ever did something like that, and that's the reason why they had that incident, and now we're looking at it, we're going to say, what are we going to do about that crew? But a lot of these investigations don't end at the root cause analysis, because we get hired a lot to do an audit of their functioning safety program and their functioning training program. So we go out there in the field as ex-linemen with a certain amount of, armed with consensus standards and OSHA standards and safety standards, and knowing the work the way and as well as we do, and having those conversations. And we find out that that crew was not the only crew that was operating under a mistaken idea of what was good, what was bad, what was the best practice, and what was right and what was wrong. So that led us to really understand that if you've got one crew out there that's making those mistakes, they're not out there by themselves. Other people are doing the same thing. And when it comes to root cause, over the 20 years that our industry has been doing root cause, and sometimes it gets very, very, very complicated and very sophisticated using all kinds of software programs and stuff like that. And we tend to do it with much more simpler form using the old Asian five whys. In other words, you ask the question, it starts off with this happened. Why? Okay, why did that happen? And why did that happen? And why did that happen? And what we end up is many times that the reason the whole thing occurred was because of the initial training that the people involved in the incident had. Only it's not just the training that they had. It turned out also to be the trainers. Now, that's where our own board, editorial board at Incident Prevention, had concerns about the article when they first read it, because they felt like it's hard to address hard truths, especially on a very, very large scale with the number of readers that IP has, when you don't do, like you and I are having a conversation, and if I say something and it's misconstrued, and you ask a question and it becomes clear to me it's misconstrued, you and I can discuss it, I can explain what it was that I meant. But if I write an article and it gets published and 4,000 people read it, how do I know the 4,000 people didn't have the same wrong impression? And I don't have an opportunity to answer that. And that's what our board, our editorial board does. They look at it from a number of different perspectives because we have a lot of very highly qualified, experienced people on the board. And they look at it and they raise concerns. And so we tuned it up several different times before we published it in order to make sure that we were trying to get the right message out without offending too many people and or without offending anybody.
Yeah.
So it boils down to what the message was that just because your trainer has been a lineman for 30 years or 40 years does not necessarily mean that they are appropriately equipped to be a trainer. They may have really very good, highly sought after skills that they can transfer to the up and coming apprentice lineman and the novice. But what do they know about all of the aspects of safety and the things that they're supposed to do? That brings us back to the USOLN's CUSP program. I was on the committee that developed the CUSP program, and I worked on especially the development of the testing. And when you develop testing, one of the responsibilities of the test developer is to do an audit of the testing to identify the efficacy of the test. Is the test really telling you what you want to know? One of the things we found while we were auditing was that groups of people from the same utilities were missing or getting wrong the answers to the same classes of material or the same questions. And when we did a deep look into why, we found out that a utility has a space that everybody works inside, and everybody in that space grows up with the same impressions about how that utility operates and what is right and what is wrong. And sometimes that right and wrong strays away from the real best practices and sometimes even the ordinances that are required by OSHA that we're supposed to follow. And they don't realize they're doing it because everybody in their environment is doing it the same way and they grew up the same way. So I did a couple of examples of what could happen over the course of a lineman's career who mentors a number of people in the history of being a lineman, because you're constantly overseeing an apprentice. And so whatever you know, that apprentice knows, and that apprentice takes it with them till they become a lineman and they're doing that same thing in the future. And so bad habits or bad information can get transferred down from generation to generation to generation. So that was the basis for the question, what's missing in your training?
Yeah.
And what's missing in your training is usually good information. Now, oddly enough, OSHA, whether they intended to address it or not, has the answer to what's missing in your training, because OSHA holds the employer responsible for the training, the assessment, the evaluation of the employee. What does that employee know? And even sets out a table of information that employee is supposed to know in order to be safe. So it boils down to the employer to make sure that the training is effective. So that brought us to the final statement that the employer is responsible for commissioning that trainer and equipping that trainer to make sure that the training that's being conducted in the field with those people is accurate. And that boils back down to the basics of the OSHA standard, but even more than that, to the consensus standards. Because what people don't recognize about the consensus standards is, you know, what they recognize is, oh, they cost $40 a set and I can only put it on my computer and I have to pay for it, or it costs $400 for a set of this or more. And they don't want to spend all of that money because, you know, my computer, I've got 70 consensus standards. I have no idea how much that costs, but most people can't or don't want to do that. I have to, because I consult with the industry to make sure that they're following the rules, and that's where the rules come from. So you have to have the consensus standards, and the consensus standards are truly the best practices. Mm-hmm. What if you look at every one of the consensus standards, the very first couple of pages of the consensus standards has a list of all of the people who contributed to the consensus standards. And I sit on several consensus committees now, for some for the IEC, which is International Electromechanical Commission, the IEEE, ASTM, and some others. And we don't actually do that for free. We actually have to pay for the privilege of being on that committee. You have to get invited by somebody on the committee, and you have to be approved in order to be on the committee. But essentially what that does is that builds a cadre of experts from many different backgrounds that contribute toward the writing of these standards, which is what makes them these best practices. And OSHA uses these consensus standards to identify the rights or wrongs that an employer is doing in the field. Now, what a lot of people don't know is that in 2014, when the revisions to the OSHA standard came out, OSHA changed the way that they address the consensus standards. They used to adopt consensus standards, which meant that if OSHA adopted a consensus standard, that the shall portions of that consensus standard were enforceable by OSHA. Well, the consensus standards can change as technology changes and as they age, and these committees make decisions on rewriting the consensus standards. And so OSHA has no way of knowing when they're going to change, and really doesn't want to go through the process of monitoring them when they do change. But when OSHA was citing a consensus standard for the purpose of adoption, they would have to do it by the version of that consensus standard. So an IEEE standard, like let's say IEEE 516, which is the energized maintenance standard, it has the date of 2009. OSHA adopts that standard for 2009, but then the IEEE comes out and revises it, and I don't know for sure, but I think the last version was 2021. So the 2021 standard is the active standard. OSHA cites the compliance with the 2009 standard, which creates a problem for OSHA. So OSHA said, well, let's stop citing them as adopted, and we'll just make them references, so that the employer can reference those standards as a means of complying with the expectations of the OSHA standard. Now, that means that OSHA, I also have to say here that this only applies to our industry. 1910-269, 1926 subpart V, the construction standard, are the only standards that no longer adopt the OSHA standard. If you're doing something like personal protective equipment that's that covers your rubber and stuff like that, that standard, which is not part of 269, may still have adopted standards in it, because the other industries and the what we call the horizontal standards still use adopted standards. The 269 and the 1926 subpart B standards no longer use the adopted standards. So OSHA may still use these best practices, these consensus standards, but they won't cite a particular passage out of the standard. They may use the general duty clause, and then cite, they may use the language that's in the consensus standard, but they'll do it as a general duty clause citation, not as a violation of a specific rule. Well, all of that to say that the consensus standards still play a vital role in creating a safe workplace because they are the best practices for the industry. And what we find out is that the, and I'm going to say the majority, and even though that's unscientific and there's no actual value there by percentage-wise, but I'm going to say that the majority of trainers that we come in contact with, and that's not a small number because I have clients all across the United States from very large national utilities to international holding groups all the way down to five-member co-ops, or munis. But we find that their trainers, the people doing their training, do not understand the value or the use of consensus standards, and most of the time don't even know that a particular consensus standard exists. So that has a big impact on what is missing in the training for our linemen who are out there who are doing this work. And it concerns me, and you know, that is a long explanation about how we got to the TikTok thing. I use social media, and I go through Facebook, and it's a great way to keep up with my family and the grandchildren and the children, and you know what else is going on with friends and acquaintances. And these videos keep popping up, and I see people doing things in these videos that are the exact same thing that are in the incident and fatality investigations that's on another part of my computer somewhere. And that bothers me a lot. But what bothers me even more is that when I take the opportunity to comment on the video that I see, the pushback that occurs. And I talk with colleagues who see these exact same things that have the exact same experience. You see somebody doing something really wrong and really dangerous, and it's being applauded as innovative and thinking out of the box and get her done, and you know all the other things that you can think of, because they have, and what that's telling us is that those people that are doing that have no idea of the danger of what they're doing, and even why that it's wrong, or even why that it might be dangerous. And then when you comment on it, you get all kinds of pushback, and I get it's almost funny because I've been doing this for 52 years. I'm pretty well recognized as a work methods expert. I'm a lineman. I've got tools older than most of the people that I see in the videos. Yeah. And I'll have people that will say, "Are you even a lineman?"
Oh, geez.
And it's like I told a lawyer one time in a court case who was trying to discredit my expertise. And I said, "I know what I'm talking about. Google me." And, you know, not a whole lot of people can say that. And I'm kind of blowing a horn there. And I really don't usually do that. But I really do know what I'm talking about. And it's not because I have, you know, anything that's special. I simply have the reams and reams and reams of data and information that I can go back to, and I can show anybody that wants to see it that this is the case. This really is an issue, and it's being missed in our industry, and it's being missed by our employers that are doing the training.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It's almost like these social media, TikTok, short form videos have shined a light on the stuff that's happening, and honestly leaves a trail for employers to look at if they wanted to, potentially their employees, what they're doing in the field that shouldn't be doing such things. And you're right, when you comment, you know, you're coming from a place of experience, you're coming from a place of, you know, hey, look, I'm concerned about the worker, but it seems like they almost get notoriety for doing stuff that they may not realize is unsafe, or they do, and they're still posting it to get that notoriety, which, you know, you have the, I mean, in the long run, they could get hurt, right? The consequences, they could get seriously injured if they don't take this stuff seriously. And the fact that you comment on it, trying to correct and give factual information, and the pushback that you get shows us, you know, there's a lack in training somewhere. You know, it's a little scary.
You know, I was thinking about some of the videos that you see are these trainees, novices, apprentices, what, you know, whatever their classification is, and they are really impressed by the skill and knowledge of their instructor, and they should be. A lineman is a extremely unique craft. We have a training requirement that exceeds the difficulty of any other skilled craft that's out there, and linemen work in an extremely dangerous environment. And if you manage to do your whole career and not get yourself killed, it says something about the quality and the integrity of the work that you do. And when these novices are out there in that training yard and they're listening to that instructor, they are not unexpectedly impressed by what they're hearing and what they're saying. And they video a lot of these times, and I hear these speeches and you know what they're saying, and I recognize it very much is the same thing that that I saw when I was an apprentice back in the 70s. When I started training, and especially in the first day of introduction, I used to say, I know that some of you think that I'm a god, but I'm not. I'm just a lineman, and you'll get it. You know, someday it'd be, and it was kind of a joke,
yeah.
But it's characteristic of the way of a lot of people think of themselves, but it's also characteristic the way a lot of people think of the trainers at the same time. So what I'm trying to impart to these trainers is to recognize that they're leaving a legacy that will far outlast their days in the industry. And when I started training, I did so, and this isn't to say that everybody should have a college education. I happened to stumble into one because of a period in my career when the economy took a beating and the contractors were taking a beating, and a lot of us were in and out of work, and I was working for a large company that was going through some political affected economical stress, and they were cutting back on personnel, and I was a manager of construction for an engineering firm, and I lost my job, and I went home to my wife and I said, man, I got to do something to bulletproof my job. And so I said, let's sell the house. I'm going back to college. And I did. And I came out, and I wasn't a better lineman for having gone to college, but I learned something. And that was the biggest thing that you can learn in education is how to learn. And so I had the opportunity then to start to ask the question, well, why is this the way that it is, which made me a better analyst. And so I became a better trainer because of that. So when I started to evaluate or to analyze what was going on in the industry, I realized the drawbacks that we had that were creating the holes in our training. And so I realized that, yeah, I knew how to climb a pole. I knew how to operate a digger derrick truck, and I knew how to build a transformer bank, but I didn't necessarily know why we did the things that we did. But I knew that there must be an underlying reason for all of that. So I started to do the research. And when I started to do the research, that's what took me to the consensus standards. And that's when I realized the value of the consensus standards and the value of consensus standards in the training for everybody, including the trainers. So it really is simple to solve this problem. It's just a matter of organizing it so everybody knows what it is that they're supposed to be teaching. It surprises me. I used an example in the article about bucket trucks. And I picked this one because right now in my agendas, I have three bucket fires that injured, or in one case, resulted in a fatal injury to a lineman. In all three of these cases, the line workers got their buckets positioned either between an energized phase and the structure, or between energized phases. And in two of those, they had cover up. So it wasn't a lack of cover. But the incident occurred because of two things. One of them is that cover, like rubber hose, cannot be used what's called in compression. So if I put a 3-aught aluminum conductor, ACS conductor, on the lip of my bucket, and I lift that conductor with my bucket, and the weight of that conductor is 600 or 700 or 800 pounds, I am compressing the rubber between the conductor weight and the bucket. Well, this rubber is not designed to be used in compression. If you compress that rubber, then it will leak. And if it leaks, voltage passes through it, goes into the bucket, or gets onto the bucket. Now, that's a consensus standard information. And it the way that we boil it down is we say that rubber goods are used for brush contact only. So I rub my shoulder against it, bump my hand against it, bump my hard hat against it. It's there for brush contact. But nobody understands what that limitation of brush contact is for. And it's there because if that rubber is in compression, it won't work. You find the same thing in a consensus standard about rubber gloves. The pressure on the rubber in the rubber gloves is limited to the amount of compression that can be created by the hand inside of that rubber glove. If you increase that compression more than that, that rubber will fail to do its job, which is to insulate that worker from the conductor on the other side. So now we've got that rubber hose on the conductor laying on the bucket. The bucket is made out of fiberglass. The boom is made out of fiberglass. The assumption is that fiberglass is non-conductive. Only that doesn't apply to the boom. And then I've got a utility that says, well, we test the bucket. And then how do you test the bucket? Well, they put the leads on the lip of the bucket, and then they put the pickup lead on the other end of the boom, and then they energize it. And that tests the bucket. I said, no, that only tests the direct pathway from that clip through the boom down to the pickup. It does not test the surface of the bucket down at your knees. That's the reason why the manufacturers don't plan for or consider that bucket to be insulating. The boom is easily identified as insulating because we can test the length of the boom to determine the electrical value or the resistance value of that boom. But we cannot test across the surface of the bucket. These guys think that their bucket is fiberglass and it is non-conductive, and when they're poorly trained and don't recognize that, they may find themselves between an energized conductor and a line hose laid on the lip of the bucket, and the side step on the side of their bucket is touching a wood pole on the other side. And that's exactly the case that occurred when electrical pathway started flowing across the bucket, got across the hoses, in the hydraulics, it burned a hole or found a hole, created an arc, lit the hydraulics on fire, burned a hose into, started a high-pressure hose, spraying oil into the fire on the bucket, and the lineman was unable to escape. This is not unusual, a not unusual occurrence. It's just that you don't hear about it a whole lot. You know, you see, I'm not telling you who the company was or where they were or anything like that, because that's not the kind of information that people are going to put out there. But it does happen. And it happens because the people that were involved did not understand the limitations of the equipment they were using, because nobody ever told them that that bucket is conductive or should be considered conductive. And every time we come across one of these and we hear this constantly, I never heard that before. I never heard that before. I've been doing this for 25 years. I've never heard that before. And that's the fault of the training that's being done, because of the limitations of training. Now, nobody's doing that on purpose.
Right.
It's simply that they didn't know that they didn't know that they didn't know. So that's the reason why I said at the beginning of the article, maybe this is the time to talk about that. Maybe this is the time to start that conversation.
Yeah, I think it's important. You know, what I'm hearing is, you know, two ways we can affect it going forward is, you know, trainers knowing the proper information and training apprentices appropriately, and consensus standards, you know, understanding them, looking at them, being aware of them are two things we can do to affect change, in addition to putting out good information like we're doing here, like you do in your article, like you do with ISBC, with consulting, these utilities, is getting the information out there and making sure that people understand it, so that we never get in a situation where someone has a fatality from it, and then learning, you know?
And that's what we're doing here. And that's the reason why I love what you're doing, Nick, and opening this up, because you know, when we teach, we use several different modes of communicating in order to get the message across. Excuse me. And this is one of those newer, more innovative and interesting ways, you know, of being able to do that. And you guys have the resources to do that. And I really appreciate that you're giving people in the industry the opportunity to get this information out there in a different way, so that it'll become part of the industry.
Yeah, I've noticed, you know, myself, I learn in a lot of different ways, one of which is podcasts, which is what we're doing here. You know, short form videos, though we were talking in a negative light initially, can be a good force of change. And so we'll cut this up into some short form videos. But I learn a lot that way too, about information that I had no idea, whether it's home improvements around the house or whatever. People learn a lot of different ways. And so you have to be in all of these avenues, and hopefully you touch somebody, you know, early enough before something serious happens, and they can train beyond that, you know. And we don't want to just create entertainment, so to speak, with these short form videos so that, you know, you get likes and comments. We want to affect real change, especially, you know, in the utility industry and safety specifically.
You know, what you said was just reminded me of two things. And one of them was that I'm almost stunned that a lot of these contractors or utilities have not taken a stance on these videos that are being published, because
that's a great point.
In some cases, they're not doing anybody any favors.
Right.
Certainly, if your crews are out there doing something wrong and somebody gets hurt, if I was, and, you know, we do a lot of litigation, you know, as an expert witness, and if I was the plaintiff's expert witness, I'd make a pretty big deal out of the fact that you knew your people were doing this photograph are doing this video, and you saw this video, and you saw that they were doing was wrong, and you didn't do anything about it. I'd hate to have to defend you against that, which is exactly, you know, what's going to happen. And actually, I do have a case right now that involves video of the crew, and the question about there's a question about the employer's response to that video. When did they know it, and did they do anything about it? So that, you know, that's you know, that's one thing. But the other part is that when I started writing the article that we're talking about now, What's Missing in Your Training, I was speaking of these TikTok linemen, and I kind of used that phrase in the pejorative, you know, sort of accusatory of not in a good light. But when I got done with the article, and I was wrapping this thing up with conclusions, I came to the same conclusion of something that you just said. They actually have done us a favor because they have, you know, I'm putting it in words, you're putting it on vehicle, on video, but they actually are the ones who opened up this can of worms by innocently publishing what they thought was, and it is pretty cool. You know, I've thought of the number of times I was at the top of a pole in storm restoration when the sun was coming up and it was, you know, working all night and it was just a stunning view, but I never took a camera up there and we didn't have cell phones and we didn't take pictures of it. And now I do see pictures and I look at those videos and those pictures and they say, yeah, I've been there. I remember seeing that. That's, you know, that's pretty cool. I understand why they do it, but they actually have done us a favor. And by bringing this to light and giving us the evidence that we need to do something about it, and yeah. And then of course I wrapped it up by telling them to put their phones away and get back to work, which is an old lineman adage about one hand on the pole because you don't have good climbing skills in trying to do work with one hand. So I was critical, but I'm really glad that they've done that. And if they keep on doing it, then we'll even get to see the changes in the industry as we improve the training that we do and the performance that we do in the field.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And one of my thoughts was I did a podcast with Brent Jeffries recently, and he had made a comment going back, you know, he had injured his eye and his wife was his co-pilot. And, you know, he used that as an example of, you know, hey, if you have a coworker, you're in a bucket truck and you're driving to a job and they're on their phone on company time scrolling social media, they should be there as your third eye, your third person looking to help support you. They're on company time. And it makes me think if these companies don't have policies yet, I would think they would. Cell phones have been around a while, but you're getting paid on company time. Being on your phone, which is a personal item, as long as it's not related to work, there's got to be some policies in place. If not yet, there will be, that restrict this kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, and you're going to stir up a hornet's nest with that because we have been a cell phone-centered culture for some time now. And there's always going to be that argument about, you know, my personal rights and all the, you know, stuff with the phone and everything else. And but what it's going to boil down to is safety of the individual. And we've been restricting certain personal rights for decades now that that affects safety. You can't do this because it's ultimately unsafe, or it raises risk. It raises risk to you and to your coworkers. And so there's ways to that we can do that. But certainly, there has to be some inalienable right for the employer to prevent videotaping of their work processes and putting them out in public. And so we might see that sometime, you know, very soon. So I encourage the use of video to show that people are doing stuff right. And even though I've stopped commenting on people doing things wrong, when I see somebody doing stuff right, I use plenty of time and congratulate them and point out why it is that they're doing what they're doing right. And so trying to be on the positive side of those opportunities.
Yeah, I think it's important to, you know, good ideas always float to the top. You know, we're in a free speech society, which is great, and good ideas always rise to the top. So I think promoting what you see as safe and following, you know, the consensus standards and taking your time to comment on those is a really good thing. And,
you know, commenting on stuff that was bad and getting that, you know, negative feedback, you know, maybe that's the right approach that you're taking, I guess, is right. What I'm trying to say. So, well, I really appreciate the time explaining and going in depth on your article. And I do hope to see change from it because I see it too. And it's, you get in some of these groups on social media and it's almost, you know, reprehensible what's going on. You know, yeah, they're doing it not knowing, but it's other people see that and, you know, what they see, they imitate. And so we need to put out positive, you know, procedures and actions, especially when it comes to safety. So hopefully we'll see change in the future, but I agree. This at least sheds light on the problem and allows us to, you know, react to it.
Great. And thank you, Nick, for your time and your resources and making them available.
Yeah.
Have a good day.
Thank you. Yeah. And we'll see you on next month's forum.
On the forum. Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
Let safety shine by joining us for the IP Utility Safety Conference in Orlando, Florida, this May 21st through the 23rd. Register today at utilitysafetyconference.com.
The views, information, and opinions expressed during this podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Utility Business Media and its employees. It is strongly recommended that you discuss any actions or policy changes with your company management prior to implementation.